Bring a Trailer Podcast.
Welcome back to the Bring a Trailer Podcast, everybody. This is Alex, and I am thrilled to say that today we are joined by Peter Egan, a longtime automotive and motorcycle journalist, acclaimed or maybe even beloved writer about car and automotive and motorcycle life. We all love Peter's Side Glances columns from Road and Track. And of course, Peter has been on many amazing automotive adventures as well. We're going to talk about all of that today. Peter, thank you so much for doing this.
Nice to be here. Good to be in California again. We haven't been back for about a year.
So. Even though the weather is maybe not so delightful.
Yeah, it's raining a little bit right now, but it'll go away.
Either you brought the bad weather or I did, Peter.
I always do. I was famous for it when we came back here to Road and Track or Cycle World. It would inevitably rain the day I got back as we were leaving for a photo shoot or something.
Well, maybe we could talk about that a little bit. I was going to ask you what came first, your love of prose and writing or your love of vehicles? Maybe you could tell our listeners, I know a lot of our community loves your work and probably knows quite a bit about you, but maybe you could talk a little bit about how you first started writing about cars and motorcycles. What was the first gig and how did you secure that?
Well, I never put it together that I could write about cars and motorcycles. They were my hobby and passion. And I was always trying to write short stories and that kind of thing. And after I sent in two novels that got rejected and a number of feature stories about different things and short stories, a friend of mine said, why don't you write about something you're interested in, like motorcycles or cars? And I said, yeah, that's a good idea. And I said, but I can't see getting published, you know, being in Wisconsin. I don't know if any of the big magazines would publish a story that you just send in. And he said, well, people have done that before, he said. The editor at Cycle Magazine got in there, you know, one of the guys on the staff, by sending a feature story, and they liked it, and they hired him. And I said, oh, it never occurred to me that could be done. And so I worked on a story about a trip that Barb and I had made with a Norton Commando, and it broke down in Missoula, Montana. We took the rest of the trip by bus and train, but so it was... It was a you know, a little more interesting trip than it would have been just buzzing out west and back.
But, that sounds like a Peter Egan classic, you and Barb on an adventure right there for your very first story.
Yeah. So I wrote a story about that, and I sent it to one motorcycle magazine that was a little bit smaller and printed more feature stories, travel stories, and they rejected it. They said, it reads okay, but we need really spectacular pictures to print it. And I just had snapshots of the trip. And so I was very depressed because I had spent about 6 months honing this story, you know, trying to get it as good as I could. And a friend of mine said, well, aren't there any other magazines? And I said, well, there's Cycle and Cycle World, but they're much larger and they don't do very many travel stories. And I said, well, what can it hurt to send it in? It's sitting in a drawer, you know, so I sent it to Cycle World. I said, they occasionally do this kind of thing.
And were they out here already?
Yeah, they were in Newport Beach. Yeah. So I sent it in and they liked it. Alan Girdler sent me a real nice note and said, we love the story. If you have anything else, send it to us. And I did that for 3 more years and then hit them up for a job eventually. By the way, I wouldn't mind working at a motorcycle magazine.
Heck no.
Yeah.
Were you consciously modeling yourself after any writers or types of stories that you read before? Or were you just really just trying to kind of write about the excitement of being out on an adventure on the road?
No, I don't think so. It's hard to tell who you're influenced by. I do a lot of reading. So, you know, I was probably reading a John Fowles book at the time. So it sounded more like him, whatever his style was. But I think you tend to absorb a little bit of everything you read.
And, as long as you steal from the best.
Yeah, That's what all the greats say. You have to steal from the best. Yeah.
And were you consciously thinking about writing about stories in cars too? Or were you just gleeful to have a motorcycle job and that's what you were going to write about?
Well, really in the late 70s when I did this, it wasn't a very good era for cars. I had worked 8 years as a foreign car mechanic. And I really didn't like where cars were going. We were getting a lot of emission controls and fuel injection systems that didn't work very well. And the cars were getting slower and less interesting right around the late 70s. And so I had shifted my interest, really. I was racing cars all through the 70s. I started out with a Bug Eye Sprite and raced in H production for 3 years. And then I switched to Formula Ford, got a Lola 204. But I loved racing, but I lost interest in contemporary sports cars. I liked the older cars, and I decided to try motorcycle racing. So I built it was a box stock Honda 400F. I decided to try motorcycle racing because that had always been another interest of mine. And I've always liked motorcycles and had owned a bunch of them. And so I went racing with that. So when I went to Cycle World, I was really involved with motorcycles. And I'd been there for 3 years when John Dinkle at Road and Track came downstairs in the same building. They were both owned by CBS magazines and offered me a job. And I didn't know what to say. I said, I'd never thought of working for a car magazine. So I went and talked to Alan Girdler, who was the editor at Cycle World. And I said, a funny thing happened. John Dinkle just offered me a job upstairs in Road and Track. And he said, well, if I were you, I'd take it. He said, because I'm leaving in a couple months. And we don't know who the next editor is going to be or what direction the magazine is going to go. And he said, you've raced cars and bikes and you love both of them. So why not open up that window of writing? So on his advice, I took the job with Road and Track.
You went upstairs.
Yeah. And of course, some people said, oh, that's a good move. And other people at Cycle World said, I think John Ulrich, who was a real hardcore motorcycle racer, just shook his head and he said, what could you possibly say about cars other than that they're useful for picking up motorcycle parts on a rainy day?
So it sounds like there was some of an upstairs downstairs rivalry there in the...
Not too much. I think a few of the people at Road and Track had ridden motorcycles and were interested. Tony Hogg and Henry Manny both, who were... Tony Hogg had been the editor at one point, was still there doing guest writing and so on. And Henry Manny III was a big motorcycle buff. He had a Manx Norton that he had just bought. And so they would come down. They like to talk about motorcycles more than cars. So they would come down to my office and talk. And they noticed they had pictures of my race cars on the wall and so on. And so I think they told John Dinkle, there's a guy downstairs who does both bikes and cars. And I think that helped that I knew those two.
And you continued working for both. Isn't that right, Peter?
Yes. Initially, I didn't do anything. I went to Road and Track and it was a full-time thing. And then after I'd been there for probably 2 years, David Edwards became the next editor at Cycle World. He became a good friend. And he came up and asked if I would be interested in writing a monthly column. So then Barb and I stayed in California for 10 years. And we moved back to Wisconsin in 1990. And I asked both magazines if I could possibly work from home and continue both columns and do a feature story for each magazine approximately every month. So I worked out a contract with both magazines.
That's what we all came to love. What was the first assignment, Road and Track? Do you remember?
Yeah, the first thing they gave me was a road test on the new Corvette, which was in 1983. It was the new 84 Corvette, I believe. But all of a sudden, I said, wow, you know, the Corvette had been going downhill for a number. Every year it had less horsepower. And, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, it was a big increase in power. They had a new engine, you know, new fuel system.
Oh, is that a crossfire or something like that?
Yeah, it was a crossfire. Yeah, I made a joke about that in the road test.
Do you remember what the joke was?
I said Chevrolet calls this the crossfire ignition system. And I said to some of us, that sounds like a malfunction. I said, stand back, kid. That car is about to crossfire. But anyway, it was good timing because cars were really getting better right then. All of a sudden, Detroit was sort of taking a hard swallow and saying, okay, instead of complaining, we've got to make these cars better and faster. And the Europeans were too. They were saying, we've got to sell cars in the American market, so we have to figure out what they want and make it work.
Some of the cars I love, Peter, the 3.2 Carrera 911 and the mm-hmm. 308 Ferrari. I really like that era.
Yeah, I did too.
Is there anything particularly memorable from that era that you remember driving or that you still think about today?
Well, it was a chance for me to drive a lot of cars that I couldn't possibly afford. Jonathan Thompson was usually sent to Italy to do Ferrari tests. He was a real expert and had written books on Ferrari, and he was not available for some reason 1 month. And they asked me if I could, they suddenly needed somebody to go and test a 308 Quattrovalvole. So I got chosen, and I went over and drove it and wrote the road test. And when the next one showed up, they said, well, you did the last one, you know, you do the new version. So pretty soon I was going to Italy about once a year and driving a car, usually a Ferrari.
Now you're the Ferrari guy.
Yeah, all of a sudden even though I'm an English car buff, all of a sudden I'm the Ferrari guy and I had to learn a lot more.
Some parallels in reliability there, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. So, but it was very interesting. I actually took an Italian course at night just so I could learn to speak a little bit. It was embarrassing to get over there and hardly be able to say hello. Or, you know, how much does it cost?
You and I were talking before we started recording how you one time saw Enzo Ferrari. Was that in this era when you were over there driving these
cars?
That
was just a little bit later. We went over to test the new Testarossa, and we had Paul Frere and Phil Hill both over there. And we were at the Fiorano test track, and Enzo Ferrari had, it was almost like a cottage. It was a two-story old-fashioned house that was only 100 yards from the track. And that was his private retreat and office. And we were finished testing for the day and we were getting ready to pack up and go back to the hotel. And somebody said, oh, look, it's the old man. And we looked up the street and there was Enzo coming out of the house and a chauffeur pulled up with a Fiat sedan. And Enzo got in the Fiat and of course he had his sunglasses on, looked at the sky for a minute and got in the car and drove away.
It was something like seeing royalty, right, everyone?
Yeah, that's the only time I've ever seen him. He was. I think he was, God, when was that? He died about a year later.
Mid to late 80s.
Yeah. I think he died in 88 or 87, 88, somewhere right in there. But it was probably a year before he passed away.
And throughout that era, Peter, you were also still doing what I think it was the kind of famous Peter Egan adventure. You're driving cars all over the country. You're with your buddy Chris, BB. You're building Westfield Lotus 11 replicas here at the road and track office. So as you went about planning what kind of work you were doing, what was the split between, hey, Peter, go drive this new car. We're going to do a road test. And you pick out an exciting adventure or a journey that you're going to do and write about.
It was a little of everything. I was expected to do some kind of a story for Road and Track approximately once a month. Sometimes if it was a big story that involved a long trip, you know, I'd skip a month. But I did a little of everything. Some road tests where I knew about the car. We did a lot of comparison tests. When I first came to Road and Track, John Lamb, who had been there a long time, said, if you ever get assigned a comparison test, really mess it up because they're really hard to do and nobody wants to do them. And if you do a bad enough job, they won't ask you again. And I said, I don't think that's really a way to ingratiate myself with the editor of Road and Track is to do a really bad job. So anyway, when it turned out I could crank those out in a reasonable amount of time, I started getting a lot of comparison tests to write. So there's a lot of detail work in that. You have to keep a lot of notes and get everybody's impressions and look at the spec sheets. And so it's a lot of tabulating things. And
you're wrangling all the other editors too a little bit, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I did a lot of that. But a lot of the travel stories I did for both Cycle World and Road and Track, when I look back on them now, they seem to be driven by two different things. It was either someplace I really wanted to go, like, you know, through the Mississippi Delta. And it was finding the right car or motorcycle that fit the mood of that trip. So I'd always wanted to see, I'm a blues fan.
Was that the Isetta? What did you take down?
Well, we took the Isetta. We were originally planning to take the Isetta to Road Atlanta. And I think there was some...
Which was a frequent destination for you.
Yeah, I went down there. I went down there. I usually covered the runoffs at Road Atlanta every year for Road and Track. I did the race coverage. So we were planning to drive the Isetta down there. And then something came up. It wasn't quite ready. We had to fix something that didn't work on the car. And so Chris said, well, we're never going to make it to Road Atlanta in time. Where else can we go? And I said, let's see what would be a good drive from here. Let's go to Memphis. Chris had never been there. And we decided to drive down the Great River Road and stay off main highways with an Isetta. You don't want to get on the interstate.
They're only about 20 horsepower or something like
that. Yeah, probably less than that. I think it would go about 35 miles an hour or something like that, maybe a little faster.
But there's no room for baggage, right? Is there?
Not much. There's some room right behind the two seats. Mm-hmm. It's probably about the same amount of room you get in an MG Midget or something to stuff luggage behind the seats. But we got everything in there. I had a camera bag at my feet and a small, you know, overnight bag to take some other stuff, clothes and shaving gear along. So part of it was finding a trip that I'd always wanted to do, and the other part was thinking about what kind of motorcycle or car was appropriate. Like one trip, I'd always wanted to go down to the Mississippi Delta and drive through it, and I just happened to come upon a neighbor who had, her mother had died, and she had a 63 Cadillac that she wanted to get out of the garage. It hadn't run for several years, so I bought it. And fixed it up and went through the water pump and hoses and, you know, all the usual things and got that working. It was actually quite a lovely car. It was a big...
That's a little different for you, Peter. You're not usually...
Yeah, it seemed like a Cadillac was the right thing. I wanted to go. I was also going to meet friends in New Orleans who were going to the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Music Festival. So I thought this would be the ideal car to drive through, you know, blues land, mm-hmm. a big Cadillac, a coffee-colored Cadillac like Chuck Berry's. And so I took that car on that trip.
Do you miss any of these cars? You know, so many of these, the MGTC or a lot of these cars and these adventures you went on, are there any of them that you think about often or fondly and you wish you still had them or had an opportunity to take on another long road trip?
Yeah, actually most of them. I always joke that if I won the Powerball sweepstakes tomorrow, I would probably just spend the rest of my life tracking down all those old cars and putting them in. I'd build a great big museum building, just put them in there so I could, go out with a drink in my hand at night and walk and look at the cars. And because there was a lot of nice cars there. But when you aren't making a huge amount of money, you sometimes have to move on to the next thing and you want to try something else. And you just can't have six cars sitting around.
Sure.
So I would usually sell one to get to try something new after a couple of years.
Some of our listeners are probably screaming, of course you can have six. You could have 60.
I could easily do that if I have a little more room.
Have you ever encountered any of the cars? Have any of those cars that you had history with, have you ever re-encountered any of them? Have you ever come across one of those again? Or has anybody ever reached out who owned one down the line?
I bought one back. I had a 356 Porsche that I bought. And I fixed the car up and I took it on a trip out to upstate New York. I went to the East Coast, first of all, and picked up my friend Mike Caccini. And then we drove up to Woodstock, New York. And we found Big Pink, the house that the band lived in. And we found the spot where Bob Dylan had his motorcycle accident.
Amazing.
And we went to the old Woodstock festival grounds and saw where the stage had been. And I always wanted to go there. And of course, Woodstock took place while I was in Vietnam. I was in the Army. So I thought it would be fun to go there. And the theme of the story was I was getting to Woodstock about 30 years late, but I was finally getting there with a 60s car. And so I sold that car eventually to a friend.
It was a B or a C? What was
it? It was a B. So I sold that car to a friend in California. And then after a couple of years, he quit driving. He was having some health problems and asked if I wanted to buy it back. So I flew to California one time, drove the car all the way back to Wisconsin. And I had planned to do a story on that trip. I had planned an extensive trip with it. And I went with a doctor friend who I thought he was all set to go for a 1 week or 8 day trip. And when we left San Francisco, where I got the car back, Napa Valley, actually, he said, oh, by the way, I got to be home on Wednesday. I've got surgery to do. And I said, home on Wednesday? We'll have to drive day and night. And he said, well, I got to get home. I got to do surgery. And I said, well, there goes the car story. Yeah. So we just enjoyed the trip instead of taking notes and pictures.
Well, that's fun. But the way I try to model my trips after yours, the way that you have always kind of meandered, taken the road less traveled, and the way you write about small Americana towns, mm-hmm. right, and diners, that's the best way to travel across the country, as far as I'm concerned.
It's a fun way to see the country. Yeah. The other thing about it is if you have an odd or interesting car, you meet a lot of people who you would never talk to if you were just driving a modern sedan. Mm-hmm. But they will follow you out of a restaurant or come down across the street to look at the car. And then you get talking to them and you find out they are car buffs and they have a collection of something and you got to come back to our house and see this. And there's nothing like an interesting car to make introductions with people in a state where you don't live and in a town where you've never been.
On the airplane on the way down, I was rereading your story where you drove a 246 Ferrari mm-hmm. through a terrible winter storm and ran it off the road and got an alignment halfway across. The many of the anecdotes you told in that story were the gas station mechanics who warmed up as soon as they knew it wasn't your personal Ferrari, but wanted to talk about it.
I've discovered over the years, people admire Ferraris from a distance, but they almost hesitate to come up and talk to you. And as soon as they find out it's not your car, every once in a while somebody would say, nice car, or something like that. And I'd sure. say, yeah, I wish it were mine. Oh, it's not yours. And then they come over. How'd you get it? Well, we're doing a magazine story. And then they're even more interested.
Sure.
So that helps a lot. But I drove a Model A Ford across the country once. And I discovered that, at least at that time, this was 30 years ago, every town you go into across the West and the Midwest, all of the older people learn to drive. And they all say, I'd learn to drive on a Model A Ford. They always use the word on, so it's still a wagon or something. Yeah. But if you pull up in a town of 2,000 people in Kansas for lunch and eat at a restaurant, half the people will come out on the street when you leave to look at the car and talk about Model A Fords, or they want to sit in it. So you end up talking to a dozen people who would just be anonymous if you just stopped in there.
There's something about a car like that that has kind of a universal appeal. People don't think you're a jerk in a Model A. Our co-founder, founder of our company, Randy Nonnenberg, he has a 56 Chrysler 300B red, and that engenders the same kind of excitement. You know what I mean? Even if people don't care about cars, they're excited to see a big 50s car with fins driving around. You know what I mean? Whereas if you're in a Ferrari or you're a jerk like me who drives a new bright colored Porsche, that's a little bit less approachable.
So, yeah, I know what you mean. I had good luck with that 63 Cadillac.
I bet.
Going down to the Delta, and I had to drive it right down through the middle of the French Quarter in New Orleans to find our hotel. And of course, it's the last year that has real tail fins. They're fairly subdued, but it's still got these long fins. And when I was driving down the street, people were almost applauding. You know, I'd hear clapping and say, great car for the, you know, the music festival. Perfect.
Totally.
And I also, it was on another trip. It was on a motorcycle trip, actually, the first one I made down there with my 400F. I went looking for Chuck Berry's house in, he's just outside of St. Louis in Wentzville.
He would have been born?
No, he wasn't born. He was born in St. Louis.
Okay.
He grew up in St. Louis, but when he got successful, he bought several acres and built a nice house in a compound near Wentzville, Missouri, west of St. Louis. But I went out there and I had to ask some local people where Chuck Berry lived. And I went out to his house and there's a long driveway and a gate. And there's a stone monument there that says Chuck Berry. So I thought, well, I don't want to ride my motorcycle up his long driveway to this house. There are several buildings. He's got a studio there and so on. And I had heard that he had weekend festivals, rock, almost Woodstock-like rock festivals there.
And for so locals or people would come in?
People from all over. Just he'd have local bands come out and play. It was a small, you know, like a small time Woodstock things.
Sure.
So I thought, well, I'm here on the weekend. Maybe I'll go see if he's having one of those. So I walked up the driveway and a very nice blonde woman came out of the house looking concerned. And I later realized watching the movie Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll that this is his secretary. But she came out and said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm a big Chuck Berry fan. And I heard that he had festivals, little gatherings here on the weekend. And I was wondering if he's doing anything this weekend. And she said, no, we stopped doing that. They got out of hand. And so she said, but you're in luck. Chuck just came back from a tour and he's playing tonight at the Rainbow Club in St. Louis. And so I found a motel near the Rainbow Club and walked down there. And he started at 8 and played till about 3 o'clock in the morning.
No
kidding. It's a huge local, just all local people, local following. It was just a small bar. I got there early and sat at the bar. I was trying to get a good spot to see the stage. And I sat next to a guy who was a steel worker from St. Louis. And he said, well, you came on the right night. And I said, why is that? And he said, well, Billy Peek is here. And he's almost as good as Chuck. And I said, who's Billy Peek? And he said, he's Rod Stewart's lead guitar player. And he just came off tour.
Amazing.
And he was fantastic. He came out and he really was almost as good as Chuck. And they loved playing together. So they played everything, blues. And I've seen Chuck Berry a number of times. And he usually does a fairly quick show and hits the road. And this one just went on and on. And he would walk out in the parking lot between sets and sit on the hood of somebody's car and have a Coke, you know, he didn't drink, and sit around and talk to everybody. And I thought, this is amazing. I just happen to be in here on a night when he's home and playing.
But these are the kinds of experiences you have when you travel or move around, or, I mean, the way you move around the country, Peter, the way you always do these trips, it opens you up to these kinds of possibilities, right? These things that can happen.
It helps to know a little bit about where you're going and then ask questions of people who are local. And the best thing to do is not pretend that you know a lot about it. It's almost better. Feigning ignorance has never been hard on my part. But, but sometimes you can be a little more ignorant than you actually are just to see what people say and find out where things are happening. And it's a little friendlier than saying, you know, I'm a huge Chuck Berry fan. Where is he? You know. But anyway, when I left that place, by the way, Chuck Berry came up the driveway driving a coffee-colored Cadillac.
Oh, no kidding.
Almost exactly the color of the one that I had. So I felt that was the right car to go down to New Orleans.
Wow, apropos. Yeah. You, as I recall, used a similar feigning ignorance technique when you and Barb flew around the country in your Piper Cub, where you were kind of helped along by strangers and people who you encountered at small town airports, right? So you kind of technique there for that.
Well, the Piper Cub is the Model A Ford of airplanes. A lot of people have called it the MGTC of airplanes, but it's actually more reliable than an MGTC.
An MGTC is more like a gypsy moth.
Yeah,
it is.
It is more like a gypsy moth. Yeah, it's everybody loves a Piper Cub. Anybody who spends any time around airports. So when they see you fly in, they immediately want to know where you've flown from.
And was yours yellow, the classic?
Yeah, it was classic yellow with a lightning bolt. And when they find out you're flying cross country, you know, you're in Louisiana and you've flown from California, you know, then they really kick into gear.
Sure.
The same thing happened to us about three different places in Texas. We'd land at a small airport in Texas and people would say, where are y'all from? And we'd tell them, Oh, you got to put your cub in my hangar for the week, you know, for the night. And then I'll take you downtown. We got a great steakhouse. So people immediately become friendly when they hear you're far from home and you have that airplane.
Sure.
It really is like a lot of the old cars. It just brings that out.
This was pilot community or this was?
Mostly pilot community.
Okay.
Yeah. People at airports, they'll walk. They might see a Cessna 150 land and just say, there's a Cessna. But if you land in a yellow cub, they'll walk over and see what you're doing and where you came from, because they know it's not from that airport.
I don't know if these exist anymore, really, but when I was a kid, anytime we'd go to some small town, he'd always want to know if there was a local airport. He'd always ask, because he'd like to go see whatever was happening at a little small, uncontrolled strip.
Sure.
And there used to be these little, I don't even know if they count as FBOs, but there used to always be one little house, and it was usually the caretaker of the airport.
Yeah,
and
still
they sometimes let you borrow their pickup truck to go into town, and you know, they usually just kind of lived there, and they were always an interesting character and always had interesting things to say.
Yeah, Barb and I we landed at an airport in Arizona, and there was a woman running the airport, and we asked if there was any kind of cab service or anything to get into town, and she just said, I've got an old Chevy parked out in back, and that's the loner car. Just take it and just fill it up with gas.
She just tossed you the keys?
Yeah, just tossed us the keys. And so all of a sudden we weren't walking anymore, hitchhiking. We could actually drive all over town and look for a restaurant.
What a luxury.
Yeah, it was really nice.
Another thing, Peter, that I think you're beloved for is your chronicling and documenting of your numerous restoration projects over the years, one of which ended up on Bring a Trailer, and I'd love to ask you about that. That was your E-Type Jaguar, and I know you had a great adventure with Barb. And for listeners, just so you know, Barb is here in the room with us, so I keep talking about her, and I'm looking at her as I'm speaking, so thanks for putting up with all this, Barb.
She's heard all this stuff before.
I know.
But I haven't driven her out yet. She's still in the room.
she's put up with it for decades,
yeah,
Peter,
yes,
and with all the people like me nerding out about it, so impressive. And she's even got a smile on her face. I can't believe it. Are there any of those project cars that you wish you had back, or are there ones that are more memorable than others? All of us who read Side Glances loved hearing you chronicle these various projects. Which of those kind of stick out in your mind and are the most memorable to you?
Well, the E-Type, of course, it's such a beautiful car that I would like to have one just to have one. If I were Eric Clapton, you know, and had a huge garage and could just write out the check, I'd probably get another one of those cars.
And that was a Series 1 or 1.5?
It was a Series 1. It was a 67. It was a 4.2, but the last year of the covered headlights and the three carbs.
Which is kind of what you want. That's my favorite.
Yeah,
I'm a coupe guy, too. I like the coupe better.
Yeah, that's a hard decision for me with E-Types, because the open two-seater is beautiful, and it's a convertible, which is a wonderful thing. But the coupe is so beautiful that it's like, to get one, you have to give up a whole lot of the other one. It was really hard to decide. And I was really of the opinion that I should just get the next one that came along that looked good and I could afford. And that's what happened.
Well, and then with the coupe, you have the ability to, if I recall correctly, you drove that one to Canada. Isn't that right? That you went on a big adventure with Barb in that car, too.
Yeah, we were trying to figure out where to go with the car. And we looked at maps of the U.S. and said, well, we always go west or we go east, or we go down to the Delta or to New Orleans, but we never go north. And I said, let's look at a map of Canada and see how far north you can drive in Ontario before you run out of road. Let's go as far north as you can drive, straight north of here in Canada, and then stop when the road ends. And so that's what we did. And we ended up in a little fishing town called Pickle Lake, Ontario. Of course, there's a lake there, and they had a marina that was full of airplanes, De Havilland Beavers and other planes on pontoons that they use. There's quite a business in taking people fishing, into the lakes. going farther into Canada.
So you basically went to where the pavement stopped?
Yeah, we did. And we said, does anybody ever drive farther north than this? And the people in the town said, well, yes, when the lake freezes, you can drive to the other side across the lake and follow a gravel road quite a bit farther north. And of course,
that's maybe not ideal for detail.
No. But the great thing was on that trip, we went to Pickle Lake, and then we got pulled over by a Canadian, I don't know what group he was with, but he was a cop, a Canadian cop. And we weren't driving very fast or anything, but he wanted to know where we're going and what we're doing with that car way up here. And I said, why are you stopping us, really? And he said, well, the Russians are buying cars like this. You've got U.S. plates. People steal them in the U.S. They load them on airplanes in remote Canadian places. And
whoa.
Yeah. And I'd never heard that. And then he kind of smiled. He said, but really, I just had a look at this car. I said, this is the first one I've ever seen on the road and you know, between Pickle Lake and wherever.
Yeah. That's a pretty thinly veiled.
Yeah, yeah. He was very nice. But so we had a lot of fun talking to him.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So that car, I think, was auctioned on Bring a Trailer in about 2019 or 2020. How did you find out that it was on our website for sale? Was that the guy you had sold it to who was selling it on BAT?
No, the guy I sold it to lived up in Minnesota, actually right on the edge of the boundary waters, not far from the Canadian boundary waters. And he had it for a number of years, and then he sold it, and I'd lost track of it then. And all of a sudden, a couple people called me and said, I think that's your car on Bring a Trailer. You know, so I had to look and, oh, sure enough, that's it.
Well, it was submitted to us as Peter Egan's car, the famous car, right?
Well, that was my old car. I did most of the work on that car. I farmed a few things out. I had the cylinder head done in California by a business called Straight Six, and they did a nice job on the cylinder head. And my friend Steve Stravelson, who's a real good engine builder, helped me put the engine.
Yeah.
Usually I do my whole engine other than a valve job, but I was so busy working on the chassis of the car. It's a very extensive project when you disassemble an E-Type. It's got a lot of parts.
Getting parts from XK's Unlimited out here in California?
Yeah. I got a lot of
Jason
parts.
Len, he just sold one of his kind of lightweight E-Type race car replica. He just sold that on Bring a Trailer.
Yeah, I got a lot of parts from him. I took the whole car apart. But at one point, I remember I walked into my workshop and I had the engine was sitting over there on an engine stand and the chassis was up on jack stands and I had taken the front subframe off, and over in the other corner is a pile of suspension parts from the front end of the car, and then the hood is against the wall. And I was a little tired one night and I came up with what I called the E-Type prayer. It says, oh God, just lift the roof off my garage and vacuum this thing out of here so I don't have to put it back together. I can't think that way. I've got to get to work. So then I got everything done, but it's a big job. It's a lot of parts in an E-Type.
Was that the most complex one you did, you think?
I think so, I would have to say yes. Yeah. And luckily I didn't have to take the rear suspension or the rear end apart. That's an extremely complicated.
Well, they come. You can put them in a hot rod. You can take that whole rear subframe out, right? The independent suspension and the differential all comes out in one chunk, I think, right?
Yeah. I think I said in the story that if you see an exploded view of the rear end of a Jaguar, it looks like a satellite shot of China if every single person were a car part or holding up a car part.
I've got four shots. I mean, they're great looking. They look really good on the back of a 32 Ford, right? No, thank you, Peter. You're braver than I am on that front.
Yeah, it was a fun project, but it was a lot of work.
Are you working on anything now? Have you given all that up? Or are you still restoring stuff?
No. I've this winter, for some reason, I haven't picked up on it yet. The last one I did was a Morgan Plus 4.
I remember reading about that. I remember reading about the Jaguar, both those.
Yeah, I spent 3 years working on the Morgan. I had a new frame and a new body shell, but everything else needed to be done, wiring and...
I think I recall you writing something about how never again a Morgan, and then you found yourself sucked back in.
Yeah, well, I have to say that might be the restoration I enjoyed doing the most, because the car is really hand-built and nothing... In a way, it's frustrating because nothing matches up. You know, the holes in the fenders aren't drilled in the same places, and it feels like it was built by hand. If somebody else had built the car, it would be slightly different.
Which it was, right? I mean, there's still... I think so. Is it Malvern?
Malvern Lynx.
Malvern Lynx. I went there when I was a kid with my dad. Same place. They've been building them forever. I think they still make the three-wheelers there, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Barb and I went there. We did a trip to England, 7 or 8 years ago.
It's almost like a pilgrimage, right?
Yeah, well, we did a hiking tour of the Cotswolds, and then I had a rental car. And after we finished that, we had a few days before we had to fly home. So I said, let's drive to Malvern. They call it Malvern in England. I shouldn't mispronounce it. We drove to Malvern, and when we got there, they were just closed for the night. It was locked up. And so we waited for the next morning. I guess it was a Friday night, or Friday afternoon, we finally went to the factory. And the gates were open, and there was parking across the street from the factory gate, so I just parked on the street with a rental car, and I walked in, and nobody told me you got out. And we just wandered around watching people work in these various buildings, and I asked somebody, I said, I heard that there's a visitor center here, and they said, oh, yeah, just go down to the end of this row of buildings and go up that hill, and that's that nice new building up on the hill. It's a visitor center. So we walked down there, and then we walked up to the visitor center, and when we got there, it was closed. So we said, well, I suppose we better head back. And as we walked back through the factory, I realized that all the doors that had been open were closed, and there were no cars parked there anymore. And we got to the front gate, and it was locked. It had a big chain and a huge padlock on it.
You're locked in?
Yeah, we were locked into the Morgan factory. And I said, well, when I was...
Maybe they wanted to get you on the assembly line and start cranking out some Morgans, Peter.
I said, when I was 16, this would have been a dream come true, but now I don't want to sleep all weekend. It was getting very cold out late in the afternoon. And I said, this isn't really a good place to be for the weekend. And so I said, let's just walk. There's got to be a guard here somewhere. And we walk around, shout hello, and there's nobody there. Finally, I said, let's go. There was another gate that was open up by the visitor center. Let's go back there. And that was locked too. And we're standing there scratching our heads, and a local man walked by carrying a suitcase. And we said, excuse me, I think we're locked in the Morgan factory. Our phones don't work here. Could you call somebody or call the police? And he says, oh, God, I'm late for a train. I've got to catch a train to London. He said, but I'll help you. He said, let's see, who can we call and get you out of here? I said, is it possible to get over the fence anywhere? He says, no. The fence was about 20 feet high with concertina wire all along the top. You don't even try to get over the fence. Nobody does it. And he said, oh, wait, I bet if you took everything out of your pockets, you could slither under the gate right there where that manhole cover is. And I looked at it and I thought, yeah, maybe. So we did that.
And that's how you guys got out?
Yeah, we got out. Yeah, we'd take all the pens and billfolds and everything, and you could just get your chin under the,
So like spelunkers. Oh,
that's a good thing.
Thank
good
you.
Thing we hadn't eaten anymore on the trip, and we just finished walking.
Pilgrimage turned out to be a little bit of a nightmare,
Yeah, but it was a fascinating factory to see, and a lot of people, of course, when they heard we were going to the Morgan factory, very, very helpful and
I'm sure.
And friendly.
You're a brand ambassador for them, Peter.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
Do you you still have that car? It's a plus four?
It's a plus four. I think it was a 65 plus four or 64. Now I can't remember. But I sold it to my friend Jeff Craig, who is a huge Morgan buff. He actually went with me to Colorado when we picked up the parts and the frame and all the stuff. It was an uncompleted project that had been left in the back of a restoration shop. And the restoration shop wanted to get it out of there. They said that the owner had disappeared during the meltdown. He was a realtor who lost everything, including his own house.
Tendency for that to happen with Morgan projects, maybe?
What's that? Yeah. So they sold it for a very reasonable price, the whole thing. But it was a huge number of boxes of parts and engine parts. And so Jeff Craig helped me. He lived in Pittsburgh and went to school in Superior, Wisconsin, went to college there. And he drove his Morgan back and forth from Pittsburgh to Wisconsin for Christmas, Easter, beginning of the school year, vacation.
All year round.
Yeah. Winter. He has all these winter stories driving his Morgan. So once I got the car built, he kept saying over and over again, if you ever sell that car, if you ever sell that car. And finally, I decided he should have it and I should move on to another project. But I haven't yet. So I'm looking around.
Hopefully he offers to sell it back to you and doesn't put it on Bring a Trailer when the time comes.
Well, I don't know. I don't think I want to buy it back. It's probably expensive enough that right now it's not where I had 5 good years with the car. And
you always seem like you're moving forward. You're moving on.
Yeah. I mean, I would do another Morgan.
What about a plus eight? Have you ever driven a plus eight? It's always exciting.
I've never driven a plus eight. I'm told by Morgan buffs that that's really the ideal Morgan. It's got all of the charm of the older ones and it's really fast.
Yeah.
And,
it's the old Buick 215, right?
Yeah.
Over 3.5 or whatever. The
aluminum
pusher up. Yep. V8. well, hope you get into another Morgan Peter, or at least something that makes you happy. What about adventures not yet taken? Are there any of those kind of brewing in the back of your brain? Places you'd like to go, or roads you'd like to travel that you haven't done yet?
No, right now, I've cut way back on motorcycle travel because I'm having some upper back pain when I ride for more than a couple of hours. So I think my long distance touring days on motorcycles are over.
But Barb said you're still riding every day.
Oh, yeah, I do. I've got friends. We go riding out in the hill country of Wisconsin every day almost. And I ride into town and back. I use a motorcycle all summer. But I don't think I can ride for 8 hours. Before the COVID epidemic hit, I was planning a possible trip to Alaska with a dual sport bike where I'd do some off-road riding.
On the Alcan Highway, is that what it's called? Yeah.
And then COVID hit and the border was closed and hotels were closed and restaurants and so on. And now I don't feel like I could make that ride. 4 years ago, it sounded like a good idea. Now I'm 76, so it doesn't sound like quite as good an idea as it did a few years ago.
The Alcan is an enticing one to me. We actually have a Bring a Trailer user. I wish I could remember his name. He bought a Ferrari 308 GTS, a Targa, on Bring a Trailer. Mm-hmm. He drove it to the top of Alaska.
Wow.
He put like dirt tires
like
on
up
it.
Up to Dead Horse.
Is it Nome? Whatever. All the way up to where it's just oil workers, basically.
Yeah,
all the way
it.
To the top. And he Instagrammed a lot of it, and so it was available. A relatively young guy, and I've been fantasizing about that trip ever since. That's maybe extreme even for you, Peter.
Yeah, well, you know, Tom, you've heard of Tom Cotter, who's written, Cobra in the Barn. And all. He went with his Cobra Club and took a trip to Alaska a couple of years ago, and we got a picture of his Cobra with the top half eaten by a grizzly bear. So I'd probably take a hard top of some kind if I went.
Maybe you need a Daytona coupe for
that
trip.
But Barb and I took a cruise ship up the Inside Passage and went to Whittier, Alaska, which is right near Anchorage, and then took a train and a bus up through Denali and went to Fairbanks. And I really fell in love with Alaska. I thought there's just no place like this. You get out and...
Does that mean you went through all those inland, the islands where Juneau is?
We stopped at Ketchikan and a number of other, you know, the Glacier Park area. And so it was a beautiful trip. And I said, I've got to come back here again. And I still haven't made
it. Tough if you like wheeled vehicles, I think. Probably easier with a beaver on floats or a yacht of some kind
I think so.
You've also done adventures in many other countries. I know you drove through the Himalayas, isn't that right? You've obviously been to Europe many times. And I think in Africa, where'd you drive the Dos Avós?
That was across the United States.
Oh, that was across the United States.
My neighbor Chris Beebe bought a Dos Avós truckette from his brother who owned it. His brother had driven it all the way through South America down to Tierra del Fuego.
Amazing.
And back with his wife.
That's a heck of a journey.
When he was young, And so Chris bought that car from him, and we both flew out there and drove it back to Wisconsin. Chris still has the car. That was a fun trip. We went through southern Canada and then across part of Highway 2 across the northern part of the U.S.
I love traveling the United States. I often say, maybe because I'm not as adventurous as you or other people, that the American West is wide open, and I could feel like I could spend the rest of my life just driving the American West. Which of those international trips that you were on is the most memorable, or maybe it was more harrowing than you expected it to be?
Well, the trip in India was very interesting because when I worked as a foreign car mechanic during the 70s, we had a mechanic who worked at the shop named Kirat Singh, and he was a very well-educated Sikh from India, and he loved cars, and he had come to America and gone through a Fiat school. So he was our Fiat mechanic. And he worked right next to me, and we got to be good friends. And at one point, he moved back to India, and he started his own foreign car specialist in India. Got really big. He's got about 300 employees. It's a huge...
Working on Fiats in India?
No. India has very few cars, at least when we were there, that were not built in India.
Oh, okay.
They had essentially two cars. They had a Hindustan Ambassador that they made in India, which was a copy of an older Austin sedan from the late 50s. And then they had, I can't remember what the other car was called, but it was essentially a Triumph sedan. So Kirat said, I can get us a Hindustan Ambassador and have my guys rebuild it. And he said, we could drive it from New Delhi to Kathmandu and see the Himalayas and maybe see Everest. And so Chris and I thought that'd be a great idea. So we flew to New Delhi, and then we drove it across up through northern India into Nepal and across Nepal to Kathmandu. Kirat and his friend Paramjit Singh, who was a fighter pilot in the Indian Air Force, they took a plane back from Kathmandu to New Delhi. And Chris and I drove, just the two of us drove back down the King's Highway into India. and then drove across northern India with the car. And that was quite an adventure.
How did the Ambassador hold up at high altitude?
It ran well. The Kathmandu is not that high.
Oh,
but
okay.
While we were there, we took an Everest flight. They've got a nice airport there. And we got the last Everest flight of the season. We didn't realize how late it was in the year for those trips. But we flew around Mount Everest, and it was clear enough weather that the clouds were starting to move in, but we got some good pictures of it.
Do you remember what the airplane was, Peter?
It was about a 12-passenger Beech. I can't remember what model it was, but it was a modern airplane. We were waiting to get in the airplane, and a man walked in dressed in almost safari gear. He had a nice canvas vest on and pants with big pockets. And Chris said, "Look at this guy. He looks like he just walked through a jungle store and bought all the right stuff for." And then Chris looked at him for a while, and he said, "I know that guy from somewhere." He says, "He was a rock and roll guy in the 60s. He's one of those old late 50s, early 60s rock idols." I said, "Yeah, he does look familiar." And so when we got in the airplane, the guy was real friendly, and he sat right in front of us, and he turned around and said, "Where are you guys from?" And we told him, and Chris said, "I think I know you from your songs." And he said, "Neil Sedaka." That's, of course, it's Neil Sedaka. We just couldn't think of his name.
Amazing.
I
like that he went through the catalog and had all the...
Yeah, well, he had, you know, this is the usual tourists. There's plenty of pockets to carry stuff in. So he was the only other person on the last Everest flight. And then we drove back. And it was a challenge driving back because Chris got pretty sick on the food. Sanitation in India can not be good in some places. Kirat says it's a lot better now than it was then.
Yep.
He said India's come a long way.
Always an amazing Peter Egan adventure. I love the Sedaka story. We're getting up on an hour here, Peter, and I wrote down so many questions. Is it okay if we do just a quick lightning round? There's
I'm going on too long with all this stuff.
Okay. No, not at all. This is what people want. Give them what they want, Peter. We were talking airplanes, though, and I did not want to leave without asking you about the P-51 that you rode in, tested against the Messerschmitt. That's one of my all-time favorite, you know, the comic road tests. I think everyone loves those. There's a Goodyear blimp one, as I recall. And you participated in quite a few of those kind of novelty road tests.
I rode a lot of them in the years that I was at Road and Track full-time. We did a sedan chair, and we did the P-51 versus the Messerschmitt.
Yeah.
We pretended that we had captured, I wrote it in a World War II jargon.
That's why I like it.
We've just captured a Messerschmitt and the old man wants us to compare it with a P-51 and see what we're up against.
Yep.
And so we said, well, the P-51 has 1,800 horsepower on combat boost and the Messerschmitt has 3.6 horsepower. You know, and so on. We made all these comparisons. And I said, the Messerschmitt took, I don't know, 20 seconds to go through the cones and the Mustang just blew them away. I had fun with that.
I love those pieces, and I think a lot of people remember them fondly, too. And one of my favorite things about Road and Track, other than side glances, was the big full-page technical spec blueprint that they would do for every car that you guys would road test. And on the novelty ones, it would be the Goodyear blimp on there, or the Queen Mary, or whatever it was, or the P-51, and I loved those. And
They were fun to do. It's fun to think of what the next... odd thing. I did the Goodyear blimp one year.
You did do the Goodyear blimp. Didn't somebody even put the little one wheeled out and try to send it through the slot?
I think so. I was on that ride. It was fun. I'd never been on a blimp before. And I also did a hot air balloon, the Pontiac Excitement hot air balloon. That was exciting. It was fun.
Quite a few aviation themed.
Airplanes along with motorcycles and cars and sailboats to some extent are my other vices.
Oh gosh, we didn't even launch into sailboats yet, but we could go there. Probably would hold, I'm going to guess. Right
Yeah, absolutely.
Gotta be. Let's see, there were one or two other ones that I wanted to ask you about. I think this was one of your trips down to Road Atlanta, but the MGTC has always been one of my favorite cars. It's, you know, in many ways, almost the prototype of the modern sports car. And as I recall, you did do a big journey in one of those, didn't you? And maybe also with Chris?
The car belonged to Chris's brother, Joe. And he had done a beautiful restoration on it years ago. And he had it in high school and got T-boned at an intersection and rebuilt the whole car. But he did a beautiful, he's a real craftsman like all the BB family and did a beautiful job on it. So we borrowed that from him and we drove it to Road Atlanta and camped most of the way down and had a great time with it. You know, it's not a boulevard cruiser or or an interstate cruiser. We took back roads, which we usually do anyway. And it was a lot of fun.
They're such a stylish, they have such presence when you're around them. I imagine that's another car that people want to stop and talk about when you're at a gas station.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people know what it is. It's surprising how many people in small towns say, "Oh, nice TC."
Yeah.
I mean, they know exactly what it is. And I think that's one of my favorite cars of all time. I think
they even smell good. I mean, they smell when you get up close to them, the hot oil and the leather. I mean,
They aren't really, they don't do anything wonderful all by, you know, any single thing. They don't shift, they shift pretty well, but they aren't real fast. And the steering, you can fix the steering and make it a little better, but they can stand a little improvement. But they're so beautiful. I think if I were to restore one more car, I think I still have it in me to get a TC. I've almost bought one a couple of times as a project car.
Would you do anything to hop it? Many years ago, this was before I worked for Bring a Trailer, when I was just a fan, Randy featured a car. It was actually in San Luis Obispo where I grew up, and it had a supercharger on the X-Pag and a, I think a T5, you know, five speed in it. And I thought, you know, just a little bit more horsepower, you know, 75 horsepower probably would be plenty with that supercharger other than a five speed. And that could probably make pretty good time cross country in something like that.
Yeah, I drove one with a supercharger. I actually looked at Al Moss, who used to run Moss Motors, lived in Arizona in Sedona. And he was a friend of ours because he was a sports car buff, too.
A lot of great cars hiding out in Sedona.
Yeah, yeah. So we went over to his place, and he said he was going to sell it. And so I took it for a ride. I'm trying to remember the name of the supercharger. It might have been a Judson was on it. It was definitely faster, but I'm not sure that a supercharger is that good for a TC crankshaft.
Yeah, probably not.
I thought, well, if I take a real one. Having looked at a few TD and TCTF crankshafts, I'm not sure I'd want to burden them with a lot of extra power for a real long time. They had their problems.
In the early SCCA days, didn't people put little V860 flatheads in those? That would be another interesting swap in those. Now I'm just opining on interesting motors to put into a TC.
I think Alan Girdler, who's the old editor of Cycle World, actually did a Volvo engine in one and raced it in some mixed class. You know, it didn't fit in
any. The brakes aren't up for any of this, I'm
guessing. No, the brakes are, I think you could update one, but at this point, to me, mostly, it's just an aesthetic. So it's a piece of art almost and a piece of wonderful nostalgia. I think I would never get tired of looking at one in the garage and taking it for short drives. And
agreed.
Just being in it. It's a charming car.
I thought, since you're such a kind of icon, I might end by asking you what the last great thing you drove or rode was. What was the last thing that you drove, rode, or sailed or flew that really impressed you? What's the bike that you're riding around every day? What are you riding on every day?
Well, right now I've got a Triumph T120. It's a 1200cc, you know, modern Triumph Bonneville.
That's a triple?
It's a twin. It looks like an old Bonneville, but it's water cooled.
Oh, okay.
And it's, I love that bike. I've got a bike from India, Royal Enfield.
Right, they make those new there, right?
Oh, yeah.
You can get it with a sidecar, too, can't you?
I think you can. I don't think the company sells them with a sidecar, but I've got a Himalayan, which is a not very fast but really enjoyable back road bike for me. And I've also had a Royal Enfield 650 Twin, which I liked a lot. I sold it to a friend of mine when I got the Triumph. If there's a project in the future right now, a friend of mine has a Ducati 900 Supersport, about a 96 or 97 SP, and I've had a couple of those in the past, and that's a bike I really loved. If I think about a project, he's got one that's been sitting for a number of years, so I can imagine it would be kind of interesting to redo the whole thing, put new belts in and check the valves and go through it and just as a project and then have a Ducati.
What a beautiful motorcycle.
Yeah, they're beautiful. I've had a number of Ducatis over the years, and they're really one of my favorite.
That's a pretty serious machine, too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, they're quick. I had a 996 Ducati for quite a while that I used as a track bike for doing track days at Elkhart Lake and other places. That was a wonderful bike, too. So, and I've been to the Ducati factory. It's not that far from the Ferrari factory. You can go to both museums in the same day if you're in Italy.
Man, that's a good trip. Yeah. There's an adventure for you.
Yeah.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for doing this. I know there were quite a few logistics involved, and you and Barb have been very charitable with your time. So
you have. You did all the logistics on this.
It's really an honor to do this. Didn't go too much into that auction for your E-Type when it was on Bring a Trailer, but you know, everyone was kind of hoping you would pop up, and when you did, I looked this morning, there's almost 190 thumbs up on your first comment you left on Bring a Trailer, which I'm sure is the most popular comment we've ever had on our website in millions of comments. So you are beloved by our community of hundreds of thousands of members, so they will be really excited
Thank you. As I told you earlier, it's the E-Type that did that. So everybody loves that car. Oh, an E-Type.
It's people love Peter Egan, people love the E-Type, or when the two come together.
It's like driving one into town. People say, oh, look at that. Who's that guy? Anyway.
Well, Really appreciate it, Peter. It's been a pleasure. So thank you for doing this. We will hopefully be able to connect again sometime, and maybe we could do this again if Barb will permit it.
Oh, yes. I think she will.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
She's put up with a lot.
She sure has. I didn't, the long-suffering Barb, I didn't know if that was an appropriate thing to bring up or not, but what an amazing partner to have on all these adventures over the decades, right?
I know. She stayed with me on our third date when my Triumph TR3 caught on fire. We were on our way to a formal dance, and I honked the horn, and the whole wiring harness went up in smoke. We had to take a cab the rest of the And she also rode in the rain back from her home in northern Wisconsin down to the University of Wisconsin after Easter, and put up with it and never batted an eye.
Been on the side of the road a few times, Barb, eh?
Yeah, she has.
Well, thank you both very much for your time. Really appreciate it. And hope everyone enjoyed this episode. If you have any feedback or any questions or anything you'd like to see us do in a future episode, please don't hesitate to reach out at podcast@bringatrailer.com. And we will see you next time.